Capitalism, a Marxist Humanist Perspectives. The session is being co-sponsored by the New Space, a new school for pluralistic anti-capitalist education, and there are flyers over on the lectern there, and also by the Marxist Humanist Initiative, a new beginning for Marxist Humanists, a new organization for a time of crises. And those little pamphlets over there also, that's available for people to take.
Thank you.
The current economic crises will undoubtedly increase the demand from working people as well as youth to know if there can be a viable alternative to capitalism. This panel will situate the problem within the current left thinking. It will also explore what Marx's body of work implies about what must be changed economically and socially as well as politically in order for another world to become possible, and will highlight areas of his work that may give us direction for working on our answers. Basing themselves on Marx's own writings and that of other philosophers such as Rydanyevskaya, the panelists will explore and debate some recent left attempts to concretize socialist theory of a new society. Our speakers are Anne Jacquard, an activist and writer in the U.S. Women's Movement and International Solidarity Movements, including most recently support for women in Iraq, Afghanistan, Indonesia, and Kenya, an organizer for the New Space and the National Secretary of the newly created Marxist Humanist Initiative, which you can get at MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, hyphens between the words. We also have Seth Wise, who is a founder of the New Space, a pluralistic anti-capitalist educational project in New York City, where you can reach at newspace@mahos.org. And also a supporter of the National Organization for the Iraqi Freedom Struggles, or noifs.org. Our other speaker is Joshua Howard. He's a founder also of the New Space and serves on the editorial board of the journal Critique of Political Economy. He's a doctoral candidate in sociology at CUNY Grad Center. And our discussant will be Andrew Kleiman, who's the author of Reclaiming Marxist Capital, a refutation of the myth of inconsistency, published in 2007. He's also a professor of economics at Pace University, an organizer and teacher at the New Space. And he's already passed out his advertisements for his book, so his website is listed on the advertisement. Okay, the first speaker will be Anne Jacquard.
Hi. The name of my talk is One System, Two Moments.
Enigmatic title. What might it mean for feminist theory to investigate Marx's alternative to capitalism, that is, to theorize the relationship between women's liberation and Marx's theory of a non-capitalist society? I don't think many people are working in this area right now, but I hope the shaky states of both capitalism and women's rights around the world will motivate feminists to reinvestigate and develop Marx's ideas as they relate to women's liberation. Today I'm speaking about two concepts I think are essential for such work. And let me say, I haven't worked this out, all right? These are two concepts I think are crucial, but I'm inviting others to help, you know, join in this kind of investigation. I hope a new investigation of women's liberation and Marx can be on very different grounds than 25 years ago when feminists wrote much more about Marx. In the past, feminist theory ran into dead ends, I believe, by failing to adequately theorize first the systemic nature of capitalism and second the dual rhythm of revolution. So I've called this talk One System, Two Moments to emphasize that I'm taking up the systemic nature of capitalism and the dual rhythm of revolution. I think these are essential aspects of Marx's philosophy of revolution for us to deal with today. So let's consider the theory that we live within a system of capitalism for a start, and let's discuss situating women's liberation within Marx's two moments of revolution. The first moment being the overthrow of capital's economic laws, and secondly, the creation of a new society. Now let me emphasize that these are philosophic moments, not temporal moments. I'm not saying first you have to do this, then you can do that. These are ideas that I think our movements have to be imbued with at all times, before, during, and after revolution. And both moments are present in each moment, but they get worked out under different circumstances. Okay. Some background on the theoretic dead ends that I see in previous feminist theory. When the women's liberation movement arose 40 years ago, many women were understandably suspicious of Marxism. The women's movement came out of the New Left in opposition to the sexism that prevailed within the left's own organizations and in the nation states that it, the New Left, considered socialist, such as the Soviet Union and China. Women who had worked tirelessly for freedom for African Americans, Vietnamese, and others suddenly started to demand, "What about my freedom?" The early women's movement conceptualized and concretized ideas about human freedom that I find to accord very much with Marx's philosophy. For example, you can compare T. Grace Atkinson's Amazon Odyssey to Marx's 1844 economic philosophic manuscripts. They share a humanist concept of the potential for human self-development. Yet the assumption arose and persisted in feminist theory that there is an inherent opposition between feminism and Marxism. For example, when second waivers declared, quote, "the personal is political," it was a big slogan back then, they were rejecting the existing left discourse centered on the politics of state power and on economic conditions. Only a few feminists, including Adrienne Rich and Margaret Randall, wrote about a completely different concept of Marx that they had found in the writings of Raya Dunayevskaya. She was the Marxist humanist philosopher to whom my own thought is heavily indebted. And if you rush down after this panel, we have a literature table, but we're only, we have to close down by 5:30, but you can come by and see. We have quite a few of the books by Dunayevskaya and others. Dunayevskaya hailed the expression, "the personal is political," seeing it not as a rejection of politics, not saying only the personal relations are important. She saw it rather as a broadening of the definition of what is political. In fact, she took the slogan as a virtual restatement of Marx's warning in the 1844 manuscript Private Property and Communism that a socialist society cannot be socialist if there is an opposition between the individual and the society. And what he wrote is, "the individual is the social entity." Marx carries forward this concept. I can't go into it because it's not the subject of this paper, but he carries it forward in his writings in the Grundrisse and Capital, and in his analysis of the hallmarks of post-capitalist society that he discusses in the critique of the Gotha program at the end of his life, and I think Seth is going to talk about that document. Many feminists in the 1970s and 80s reacted against what they thought was Marxism by turning instead to theories of patriarchy to explain the condition of women. They ignored Marx's humanism and painted him as an economic reductionist whose theories could not account for the length, depth, and breadth of sexist societies. Patriarchy came to be seen as a more important and more intractable cause of women's oppression than was capitalism, and so it received the feminist attention. Now, I find that most of these theories of patriarchy suffer from what's called the genetic fallacy. The genetic fallacy holds that the origins of a form of oppression determine the role that oppression plays in current society. And I don't think that's the case. No one disputes that patriarchal culture existed before capitalism. But that doesn't mean that it plays the same role in reproducing modern society that it did in ancient societies. Yet by making patriarchy the systemic basis of modern society, radical feminist theory concluded that women needed to fight against patriarchy instead of capitalism. After all, a system is the distinct, all-encompassing, self-generating, and self-perpetuating method by which a society operates. There's no room for two complete independent systems governing the same society. Even those feminists who consider themselves socialists or Marxists largely failed to investigate what the specificity of women's liberation might mean for developing Marxist philosophy. Instead, they by and large played lip service to a class analysis reserved for, quote, economic relations, while concentrating their attention on the origins, dominance, and needed uprooting of sexism. Their approach took the predominant form of dual systems theory, is what this was called, dual systems theory, in which patriarchy and capitalism were treated as if they're two separate systems that coexist in the world somehow side by side without interpenetration. Capitalism, they wrote, controls so-called economic issues, such as the exploitation of women's paid labor and the unfair distribution of resources and products of labor, while sexism dominates and determines all relations between people, as if economic relations were not between people. So these relations between people is everything else. Unpaid labor, job discrimination, feminization of poverty, love, family relations, culture, etc. Even socialist feminists like Heidi Hartman, who claimed they were not creating dual systems theories, really did. They ended up combining a few concepts from Marx with a separate system of patriarchal relations. And the seminal work on dual systems is Hartman's essay called The Unhappy Marriage of Marxism and Feminism. She actually comes to the same conclusion there as the radical feminists, although she says she's not. Then the conclusion is that because men receive benefits from living in sexist society, sexism must be fought in a separate sphere from capitalism. By focusing on men's relative advantages, she misses the fact that capital is the real beneficiary of sexism. Men may have a few more advantages than women, but we're all living miserable lives because of capitalism. For example, if we look at the job market, employers hold down everyone's wages by pitting women against men, just as they, you know, pit ethnic groups against each other. Or if you look at the home front, where the custom is unpaid labor, again, that holds down everyone's wages because you get unpaid labor at home. First, dual systems theory is a gross understanding of the workings of capitalism, which I believe affects every aspect of the modern world, from the local to the global. I'm not going to go into it, but we can discuss it later if people want. Patriarchal ideas persist within capitalism. The ideas persist, ancient, horrible prejudices. I believe they persist to the extent that the ideas are useful to capitalism, right? Some ancient ideas have died out, like, whatever, worshipping the sun, it's got no use, but sexism is extremely useful. The point here is to work out what is systemic, because that cannot be reformed and must instead be overthrown. So that's the question. If capitalism and patriarchy developed independently in our independent systems now, then they need to be overthrown separately. In dual systems theories, the relationship between the two systems is left external, as if they could coexist without affecting each other. And this leaves Marxist feminists in a difficult position. What do we fight for and not just against? Will a victory within one system really change women's lives? Well, most immediately, can capitalism be reformed to accommodate women's liberation? This is really the issue. Do we have to get rid of capitalism? That's why the concept of system is so important, in my view. If we fight only to change the outward manifestation of oppression without changing the system's inner workings, then we cannot make deeper permanent changes. And that's a lesson that feminists should have learned from the rapidity with which the Reagan-Bush counter-revolution reversed the victories that mass movements had won in the 1960s and 70s, including reproductive rights. The concept of capitalism as a system is crucial to understanding today's economic crisis. Much of the left has fallen for the illusion that capitalism can be reformed by state regulation or redistribution of wealth, capital, right? I don't know why all the left wants to save capitalism, but they do, right? Oh, regulations will take care of everything, or nationalization will take care of everything. No, I think that's another discussion, but we have to face capitalism's got to be uprooted, destroyed, and replaced, I believe, with an alternative mode of production. And that, I think, is the essence of what Marx is about. Now, the fact that capitalism is the system within which sexism is perpetuated in the modern era doesn't mean that overthrowing capitalism will automatically eliminate sexism. On the contrary, a revolution in the mode of production is necessary, but not by itself sufficient to lay the material and social basis for socialism and women's liberation. I contend that a huge thinking women's movement is essential to the process of transforming human relations and must be active thinking as well as fighting, before, during, and after the transcendence of capitalism. Only such movements can work out what freedom for women will really look like. Here we need to tarry on the concept of the two moments of revolution. 40 years ago, again, feminists were acting against remnants of the old left view as well as the new left practice of sexism. But the old left view, before 40 years ago, had been that nothing could be done about women's unfreedom until, quote, after the revolution. So it's a waste of time, if not an outright diversion into bourgeois reformism, to even take up issues like women's rights. And that idea came from a really corrupted, completely inaccurate view of Marxism that communists, read Stalinists, told people, not only women, but black people, colonized people, etc., you know, don't fight for your own liberation. You got to do what we plan for you to do, and someday in the great beyond we'll get to your liberation. But that was a long time ago. After the past 60 years of national liberation movements, the U.S. civil rights movement, African movements, and a worldwide women's movement, that old party line is pretty dead. But in reaction against that view, theorists and not only feminist ones have, let me see where I am, okay, have, as I see it, concentrated their thinking on changes in power relations. Power relations. What group is going to have the power to get their rights and material benefits for them? Whether advocating the seizure of state power and national resources, or independence or separatism, including feminist separatists, the theories of these movements concentrated on political control and property relations rather than on destroying the capitalist system. Theoretically, this approach allows room for identity politics to be the prevailing thought, relativist standards of freedom, you know, well, you have your idea, but I have mine, and the prospect of reforming capitalism. It limited, I believe, the ability of revolutions to articulate views of truly new free societies. post-capitalist societies. And so it is these failures of the 20th century revolutions to establish socialism in any lasting way anywhere, which I believe compels us to delve deeper into the dialectical nature of the process of revolutionary change. So I want to take up very briefly this concept of two moments of revolution, again, philosophic moments of revolution. Marx's concept of an alternative to capitalism is based not only on uprooting capitalism, but on a second negation, to use the Hegelian concept as Marx did. The second negation Marx termed, quote, positive humanism, beginning from itself. In other words, first we're against something, we have to destroy it, and everything we do is devoted to destroying it. But the second moment of the dialectic is the positive, when we begin to create the new without reference to the old. We're no longer defined by what we're against, defined by the old existing society. We're now free to create something totally new. And that's when we will develop our full capabilities from an absolute standpoint. For Marx, the forms of private property that characterize capitalism, including the treatment of women as property, are historical, transitory, and subject to the transformative activity of human beings. So the first moment of revolution must be uprooting of the capitalist system. But the second moment, which, as I said before, has to be there always in some form, but which doesn't get to flower until we get rid of capitalism, is working out new society in all aspects. Now, everybody wants to get to second negation, right? Everybody's just dying to get to that wonderful new society. But it's not so easy to theorize how to do it, where to do it, when to do it, or even the first negation. What precisely must we do to uproot capitalism and to change capitalist relations of production? We should have learned from history that it's insufficient to change the people at the top, or even to eliminate the people at the top. And as I believe Seth will discuss, you can't just declare you're no longer working in the capitalist mode, because all the same forces that drive capital to continuously expand are still operating, and you can't work differently all by yourself. Let's assume one day you can manage to stop capitalist production worldwide. Okay, great. But now how do we have a new mode of production? How do you stop producing for value and only produce useful goods and services? How do you work cooperatively and humanely and environmentally safely and still produce the goods and services that are needed for the whole world's population? I'm not suggesting we're going to work out a plan for this. I'm suggesting we have to think seriously, theoretically, about breaking down these concepts into workable pieces to think about and to engage with the working class about. Because it's going to be too late after the revolution to just start saying, gee, I wonder what we should do now. Capitalists are going to be waiting in the wings to come back in. Okay, let me just finish. The change to a new socialist system won't happen automatically, nor by voting to do so, nor by putting good-hearted women in control of production. A major focus of my organization, the Marxist Humanist Initiative, is to theorize this first step of actually changing the mode of production. My point is to recognize that it needs theorizing, as do the relations of both the first and second moments of revolution to women's liberation. In conclusion, we need to fight existing society on all fronts, including fighting for women's freedom everywhere. But we cannot leave to others the hard task of theorizing the process of revolutionary transformation. I think that begins with understanding, one, the systemic nature of capitalism, and the two moments of revolution needed to establish another world. Thank you.
My presentation is entitled Silicon Valley Socialism. I'm going to be looking at the work of Stephen Resnick and Richard Wolff on communism. It is now widely recognized that we are caught in the grip of the most serious economic crisis since the Great Depression. The IMF's chief economist remarked a few months ago, quote, "We now expect the global economy to come to a virtual halt," end quote. And the IMF, in an update to its World Economic Outlook, projects world growth to fall to just 0.5% in 2009, its lowest rate in 60 years. Yet, the notion of even talking about an alternative to capital elicits disinterest, scorn, and ridicule for many on the left. An important exception is to be found in the work of Stephen Resnick and Richard Wolff, who have tirelessly advanced the conception of communism that is non-deterministic and exhibits a class structure. Here I want to explore their conception of communism. I will argue that Resnick and Wolff's exclusive focus on the production, appropriation, and distribution of surplus labor leads them to mistake worker-run cooperatives for a model of an alternative to capital and blinds them to the real power of what Marx calls the law of value. I will also, drawing on the work of the Marxist humanist philosopher Raya Denisovskaya and more recent work by Andrew Kleinman down on the left there, try to sketch some ground for thinking about a more thoroughgoing and liberatory alternative to capital. Resnick and Wolff are both economists by profession and have had a long association with the University of Amherst, University of Massachusetts Amherst. Wolff, I think, now teaches at the New School here in the city. In 1988, Resnick and Wolff launched, along with others at Amherst, the journal Rethinking Marxism. Wolff is likely the most influential Marxist commentator in the U.S. on the current crisis. In a recent lecture entitled Capitalism Hits the Fan, Wolff argues that measures aimed at the regulation or re-regulation of the economy won't be able to resolve the present crisis. Instead, he argues for, in his words, radical changes. Drawing on the entrepreneurial initiative of engineers in California's Silicon Valley, this lecture, which was filmed and was apparently screened earlier here at the Left Forum, there's actually a transcript of it available too, and I want to quote briefly from it. According to Wolff, quote, "Over the last 30 years, every year, hundreds and in some years thousands of engineers in Silicon Valley have quit their jobs working for big companies like Cisco or IBM and have set up little enterprises amongst themselves. And they come to work each day not wearing a suit and tie and not taking orders from a supervisor whom they don't like. Instead, they come to work with their laptops, wearing Hawaiian shirts, grasping a frisbee, maybe with a dog, maybe with a toddler, and having a wonderful time in a new little enterprise. And here's how they run their enterprise. We're all equal here. No one's a supervisor. We're going to do this all as a group. And from Monday to Thursday, we're going to make software programs the way we always did. But on Friday, we're going to come to work and we're not going to make software. On Friday, we sit around all day and have meetings because we are our own board of directors. We decide what to do with the profits we've earned. We decide whether to change our technology or to have more people working here or whatever," end of quote. Here, Wolff finds what he calls, quote, "Marx's idea of a communist enterprise," end quote. According to Wolff, quote, "So successful are these little businesses that a Marxist might say, gee, all those basic breakthroughs in computer technology that are typically boasted of as the achievements of modern capitalism aren't. They're the achievements of communist enterprises operated by Republicans in Bermuda shorts in California," end of quote. What Wolff is advancing here, the worker-run cooperative, is nothing new. And today there is a renewal of interest on the left in worker-run cooperatives, worker self-management, and similar forms. Marx, however, was clear that worker-run cooperatives are not in and of themselves an alternative to capital. In Volume 3 of Capital, Marx argues that cooperative factories run by the workers themselves are a harbinger of the new society, but they, Marx says, quote, naturally reproduce in all cases all the defects of the existing system and must reproduce them, end quote. Here, says Marx, quote, the opposition between capital and labor is abolished only in the form that the workers in association become their own capitalist, i.e., they use the means of production to valorize their own labor, end quote. While worker-run cooperatives and the like may be a harbinger of the new society, they should not be confused with the new society, nor do such forms in themselves present a path to the new society. In Capitalism Hits the Fan, Wolf argues that regulation has failed and will not solve the current crisis because corporate boards of directors have both a tremendous incentive and the necessary means at their disposal to evade and defeat efforts to regulate the economy. Wolf asks us to quote, imagine the difference if a new system of regulations, say passed by Mr. Obama, were to confront a different organization of production, one in which not a board of directors responsible to shareholders ran the businesses, but instead the people who worked in every business ran the business. End of quote. Wolf maintains, quote, because they all have to live with the consequences, then you have people on the inside of every business partnering with the government to make sure that the point of the regulations was realized, rather than a group of people who would function to undo and thwart the whole point and purpose of the regulations, end quote. There is no reason to believe that what Wolf is proposing represents a fundamentally different organization of production. Throughout Capital, Marx treats the capitalists and the workers as the personifications or bearers of production relations. If we leave capitalist production relations intact, but change the faces of the bearers of these relations, in this instance, replacing corporate managers with software engineers, we have not fundamentally changed anything. I think we need to ask a very basic question. Namely, can capital, regardless of people's intentions and motivations, be managed or controlled? Is capital, self-expanding value, value that begets value, something that is neutral? Were the leaders of the Soviet Union, China, and the other state capitalist regimes that called themselves socialists able to control the economy, or did it, the economy, control them? Why should we think that workers would have any more luck with such an endeavor than bureaucrats or corporate managers? More fundamentally, is the revolutionary project one of trying to manage the economy or one of creating entirely new production relations in which we can find true mastery over the process and products of our productive activity? As the current crisis makes clear, we live in an inverted world, a world in which the products of our own hands operate independently of our will. The issue, ultimately, is not who is nominally in control of the workplace, but whether or not the production process itself has domination over us. I want to turn now to some of the theoretical work that underlies Wolf's advocacy of Silicon Valley as an alternative. Okay, thanks, Ray. Resnick and Wolf advance a distinctive analysis that takes class as its entry point. They define class in terms of how society organizes the production, appropriation, and distribution of surplus. They locate five major kinds of what they call class structures. that, in their words, are recognized and analyzed in the Marxian tradition. These are the capitalist, the feudal, the slave, the ancient, and communist class structures. These five class structures are understood as the basic ways to organize the surplus. The feudal, the slave, and capitalist class structures exhibit exploitation. That is, the performers of surplus labor are not also the appropriators and distributors of the surplus. In communism, by contrast, Resnick and Wolff maintain, those who produce the surplus also collectively appropriate and distribute the surplus. The only systematic discussion of class in Marx's work occurs in Volume 3 of Capital and consists of less than two full pages. It is, however, evident from this chapter in Volume 3 and the preceding chapter on relations of distribution and relations of production that Marx understands class as a derivative category. The capitalist mode of production does not flow out of the rule of the capitalist class. The income distributions and class antagonisms of what Marx here calls the three great social classes, capitalists, wage laborers, and landowners, are not generative of the mode of production, but rather they are derivative of it. Resnick and Wolff's treatment of class and surplus, which conflates what they call class structures with modes of production, risks an inversion of Marx's conception, while, as we will see, ignoring the historical specificity of value production. Resnick and Wolff maintain that communism is a class society and describe the idea of a classless society as quote-unquote utopian. This flows logically from their binding of surplus with class. By definition, in their theory, when a society has a surplus, it has classes as well. It is well recognized, however, that Marx understood what he called communism or socialism, he used the terms interchangeably, as a classless society. Moreover, not burdened by a theory that necessarily binds surplus with class, Marx had no difficulty in conceiving of a classless society with a surplus, as seen in his Gothic critique, to take one prominent example, which I'm going to get to shortly. Resnick and Wolff place great stress on exploitation, that is, the extraction of surplus labor or unpaid labor. Curiously, however, their conception of communism is compatible with exploitation, not the exploitation of workers by the capitalist class, but a kind of self-exploitation, as we can see in Wolff's Silicon Valley model. The fact that workers rather than capitalists might appear to be calling the shots in the workplace does not constitute an arrangement without exploitation. Worker self-management, in the absence of a clear break with value production, is a form of self-exploitation. Here, workers, to reiterate what Marx says, valorize their own labor and become their own capitalist. The fetish that Resnick and Wolff make out of the surplus, a kind of postmodern Ricardianism, perhaps, blinds them to the objective power of what Marx calls the law of value. The law of value, abstracting from the issue of exploitation, centers on the determination of value by socially necessary labor time. In Volume 1 of Capital, Marx shows that a commodity has both a use value and a value. And he shows that the substance of value is abstract labor, and the magnitude of value is determined by the amount of socially necessary labor time that is required for its reproduction. Marx says in Volume 1, quote, "Socially necessary labor time is the labor time required to produce any use value under the conditions of production normal for a given society with the average degree of skill and intensity of labor prevalent in that society," end quote. One important way in which the law of value manifests has to do with the fact that in this society, our labor is not directly social. This has enormous implications and is likely the main source of poverty and inequality in our world. what does Marx mean by the term directly social labor? Not all labor in our society is counted equally. Some labor counts more than other labor. Some people are stronger or smarter or healthier than other people. Some people are working with more advanced tools and technology. In our society, the value of a commodity is determined by the amount of socially necessary labor time required for its reproduction, and any labor time beyond that which is socially necessary is wasted. It is simply not counted in our society. How to create a society in which our labor is directly social is, I think, the central problem that all of us trying to develop an alternative to capital need to grapple with. In his 1875 critique of the Gotha program, Marx projects a vision of a new society in which labor is directly social. Describing what he calls the lower phase of communism, Marx writes, quote, "Within the cooperative society, based on the common ownership of the means of production, the producers do not exchange their products. Just as little does the labor employed on the products appear here as the value of these products, of those products, as a material quality possessed by them, since now, in contrast to capitalist society, individual labor no longer exists in an indirect fashion, but directly as a component part of the total labor," end quote. In capitalist society, precisely because our labor is not directly social, the labor of some workers counts more than the labor of other workers. Labor exerted in excess of the socially necessary labor time required for the production of a commodity simply does not count. Here, in this lower phase of communism or socialism, our labor would be directly social. Here, there is no market, as the producers do not exchange their products. There is no commodity fetishism, something Josh is going to be talking about, as the labor employed on the products no longer appears as a material quality possessed by them. And there is no value production, as individual labor is now directly social. It is not yet possible for society in this phase to inscribe upon its banners, "from each according to her ability, to each according to her needs." This will have to await a profound development in productivity and a profound development of the human individual. Still, Marx considered the lower phase to constitute an absolute liberation, as labor here has become directly social. It is important to be clear that Marx is projecting this as emerging the day after the revolution and not in the course of some lengthy transitional period or something of that kind. Okay, I'm going to try to wrap things up. I want to stress that regardless of the limitations of Resnick and Wolff's conception, the fact that they don't shy away from theorizing a new society is of real import, particularly insofar as it opens up space for dialogue on the issue of alternatives. We have witnessed the resurrection of the S word, socialism, from the campaign trail to the cover of Newsweek. And the current crisis is producing a growing disillusionment with capitalism across the globe. However, after so many failed revolutions and counter-revolutions, the idea of socialism will never again grip the imagination of a great many unless we are able to theorize a concrete, thoroughgoing, and liberatory alternative to capital. That's it for me. Thank you.
Next speaker is Joshua Hart.
This is entitled "What Fetishism Can Tell Us About Today's Crisis and a What Fetishism Can Tell Us About Today's Crisis and a possible Future." I want to just start on something Seth said, that talking about alternatives to capitalism is, I think, a good thing to do on the left. And it is productive in the sense that critique can be productive of new ideas, but only if you debate honestly and are willing to rethink your own ideas. So that's what really needs to be done in a dialogue, and that's what the New Space, which is a pluralistic anti-capitalist education project, has a mission to accomplish, to have real dialogue and development of ideas on the left. I start with a quotation from a recent book by a Harvard economist, Stephen Marglin, who recently published a book called The Dismal Science: How Thinking Like an Economist Undermines Community. He's a left communitarian socialist who's very anti-market. By market, he says, I mean something different from the variety of markets that have been with us since time out of mind and exist in virtually all societies. I mean with Karl Polanyi, the Hungarian socialist, a self-regulating market system. A world in which markets collectively allocate resources, set prices, determine the distribution of income. In short, a system in which markets provide for our needs and wants, and from which we derive our sustenance. And something more, a system that not only regulates itself, but also regulates ourselves. A process that shapes and forms people whose relationships with one another are circumscribed and reduced by the market. I mentioned this because just wanted to put it out there that not only Marx is talking about the capitalist mode of exchange in these terms. Marglin is actually saying how the system regulates itself, although not very well, and ourselves, kind of domination over us. And from a communitarian perspective, disintegrates the kind of community that he wants. But I also want to stress that commodity fetishism only manifests itself in a market system, but that is something that many on the left have stressed, and it's not hard to find people that conceive of the market as a system. But there's less theorizing about how this arises from the total system of capitalist production. Most on the left have considered production to be one thing and the market to be another. Even when they assert the connection explicitly, often their arguments reveal the opposite implicitly. I will say that thinking of commodity fetishism in terms of exchange of things is not completely off the mark and has the benefit of directing us closer to what Marx's own concept was, and it's much closer than the other great misinterpretation, which is thinking of commodity fetishism as in terms of consumption and desire for consumer goods, which is simply nuts. I mean, there's no talk of consumption in Chapter 1 of Capital at all. So the specific meaning of market, I think, which is a very slippery word, needs to be defined. Otherwise, we are confounding a lot of things that are not the same thing, as Marglin points out, and should especially be done by the left. So commodity fetishism does not simply manifest itself in any sort of process of market exchange. What Marx was singling out was not exchange as such, but commodity exchange. And even more specific than that, what is decisive is not exchange in general, or even exchange with money specifically. Money is pretty old. What's decisive is a specific social character of labor, which is performed in capitalist society, capitalist economy, which emerges at a specific moment in history when useful things are produced, and this is a quote from Marx, for the purpose of being exchanged. So that their character as values already to be taken into consideration during production. And so the intentionality of the producer, the production process, matters here. To further quote, from this moment on, the labor of the individual producer acquires a twofold social character. So you have a number of different voices talking about capitalism on the left, right, center, but really often they mean the market and not production. For Marx, the problem with the fetishism of commodities, the fetish power that things, that our products of labor have over us, stems not from their participation in a market, but rather the specific features of commodity exchange stems from the specific features of commodity production, not vice versa. And it is the capitalist mode of production that results in the systematic nature of market behavior, including the crises. So commodity fetishism is not simply about exchange, nor exchange for money, nor is it primarily about exchange according to some quantity, whether equal or unequal. So efforts to understand commodity fetishism as hiding some process of exploitation behind a veil of prices, or as Lukács' notion of reification would have it, the quantification of the world, reducing everything to numbers or something, are not on the mark either. Rather, it is about a certain system of commodity exchange that emerges necessarily from production, capitalist production. And the section on commodity fetishism in Capital highlights what is at issue in the systematic nature of this production. By understanding the section of Capital, I think you can go a long way to understanding what is unique about Marx's analysis of capitalism, and thus I would argue a long way to formulating how a new society would need to be to organize its economic activity to avoid unintentionally falling back into capitalist relations of production and exchange. As soon as we realize that the fetishism is not primarily about market exchange or consciousness or a lack of political will or consumer desire, we will understand how difficult the changes in the organization of production need to be and the difficulties we would face in trying to remake society on a new economic foundation. On the other hand, it would seem to me a lot easier than changing consciousness, whatever that means. I mean, you can't get into the heads of everybody. I mean, it's ridiculous to even think that you would need to have a new society. I mean, that's kind of like scary mind control. A proper understanding of the fetishism of commodities also shows the inadequacy of recent reactions to the economic crisis, such as the populist rage, the scapegoating, the conspiracy theories, and other attempts to personify the crisis in terms of greed, elites, politicians of every stripe, or even banking and finance institutions, as if the economic system is otherwise healthy without these parasites. So I'm just going to go through a little bit of what the commodity is, what commodity fetishism is, the underlying relations of production, and then the system as a whole, and finish with some thoughts about how this can spur forward thinking of a new society. So beginning with the commodity, it's a dual form. It has value and use value. That's what is kind of definitional about the commodity for Marx. So you begin with this, with what Marx calls like the simple form of value, which is, he used 20 yards of linen equals one coat, but it could be any number, any unit of commodity, of any commodity is equal to some unit of another commodity. And often that's expressed in money terms or price. So Marx shows that he's not really talking about any exchange relation. I mean, you can trade anything for anything, and it's not what he's necessarily talking about. He's talking about this this relation of equality in capitalist relations of exchange. In other words, the quantitative equality, the number equal to another number, is underpinned by a qualitative equation. In other words, there's some quality that is common to each of these commodities that allows the quantitative equality to be more than arbitrary and contingent, more than the whim of the exchanger. This something is value, and it gives the relation between commodities a law-like quality, exchanging according to a ratio of the magnitudes of value. The qualitative equation, the fact that diverse commodities are exchanged on the same basis, having nothing physically in common with each other, is what makes the equation of their quantities an unnecessary one. Otherwise, you're just comparing apples and oranges, literally, not price-wise. And this is what is unique about capitalist production, or the results of capitalist production. Marx points out three features of the commodity fetish, the first two of which are intrinsic to commodities, and this third is relational, and so independent of... And the first two are intrinsic and so independent of exchange. The third is relational and therefore having to do with that relation. So one is that the expression of labor, the labor of everyone in the economy, is expressed in the value of the commodities. And the expression, and then the corollary to that is the expression of the duration of labor, the labor time, is expressed in the magnitude of the value of the commodities. Now, in the third is relational and necessarily results from the first two. than the first two intrinsic ones, meaning that because they have a certain magnitude of value, they have a relation to each other, which is a social relation. So the third thing and the controversial aspect of commodity capitalism is the expression of relation, of the relation between everyone's labor, is the social relation between the products of the labor. So that the social relation between things. It is because things have value that they are related in this way. As Marx writes, the relation between people and their work appears as a social relation between things, because that is what there is. There is a social relation between things. It is a social relation between things not because they are exchanged by people. They are exchanged by people in the way they are because there is a social character that they share in common, which causes them to be related in a social way, independent of people. I quote from Capital, the value and character of the products of labor becomes firmly established only when they act as magnitudes of value. These magnitudes vary continually, independent of the will, foreknowledge, and actions of the exchangers. In the midst of the accidental and ever-fluctuating exchange relations between the products of their labor, the labor time socially necessary to produce them asserts itself as a regulative law of nature, and he compares this to the law of gravity. As an analogy. But, you know, there were other people espousing kind of natural laws of society, from Hobbes to Condorcet, or Condorcet, or whatever, and I think that's kind of what he had in mind. It is a human law. It is like a law of nature in the sense that it is independent of the will. It's not a law of man, or a law of people, like a legislative law. So it's this moment when things take on a life of their own. The social relation between things has given a lot of people trouble, who think Marx means that although it looks in the market like there's a social relation between things, independent of the will of the producers, well, really there's a social relation between people, and the rest is just an illusion. But it's not true for Marx. This whole discussion of the social relation between things just follows like almost immediately from his discussion of the commodity in the rest of the previous three sections of the chapter one of Capital. It just follows from the commodity form as he says. Commodities have this social substance in common, and they have differing amounts of it, which determines the ratio in which they exchange. And people don't determine the ratio in which they exchange. This process of exchange is a relation, and it's based on, and it's a social relation. The second, it is a social relation by virtue of being produced, owned, of there being, it is not a, sorry, it's not a social relation between, by virtue of there being produced, owned, and exchanged by people, as in trading between tribes or families for the purposes of creating bonds. It's social because it's given this value by a certain kind of labor. It's true, as Marx says, that commodities don't bring themselves to market. They have to be brought by people who engage in those social interactions, those market relations. But it is not these social interactions that make the relation between things social. it's the relations are social, independent of the producers and exchangers. The character of the social relations are independent of the character of the social interactions on the marketplace, in the marketplace. People can't make the prices they want them to make the goods the prices they want them to be, at least not systematically. You can cheat people here and there, but or you can have a monopoly, but it's not you can't do that systematically. You can perhaps think of it as follows: if it's not the commodities that bring themselves to market, it's the commodities that compel people to bring them to market and dictate their performance on the market. So the underlying relations of production that I want to talk about kind of steers us away from discussions of class. It's not capitalists who are in control of this. Steers us away from discussions of property. It's not about legal contracts and such. And it's not even about exploitation, because he doesn't mention exploitation until much later, chapter 6 or 7. So you can take a system of workers, collectives, communes, free associations, whatever, what have you, and put them in the place of the capitalist enterprises, and you simply just get the same effect, regardless of form of ownership or control of the means of production. So saying we'll take over the means of production is not a solution, it's just simply a restatement of the problem. Okay. there just is this social relation between these workplaces, all these numerous workplaces creating numerous, with numerous workers creating numerous things in a certain way. That is the social relation between the social relations of production. The market is simply an appearance of what's already there underneath it all. So it's not as if like you have this private production and then you have like the market is social. The production is already social. But it's a specific kind of social. I mean, a lot of labor is social. I mean, feudal labor, slave labor is social labor. So due to the constant variations of these individual production processes, not to mention like disturbances in the relations of supply and demand, the prices fluctuate, and this is determined by the amount of labor that is contained in the different commodities. Marx writes, the movement of the is out of the control of the producers and exchangers. Their own movement within society has for them the form of a movement made by things, and these things, far from being under their control, in fact control them. So the question that it raises is how else, although it doesn't coordinate it all so well, how else is like production on this scale, on a world scale, able to be coordinated? How is planning possible? I personally think that central planning would simply not work. So it's kind of instructive to see how capitalism does it and how it might be able to be done in a socialist way that isn't centrally planned. Because you have countless localities on Earth. I mean, just simply, I don't think there's any way of being able to coordinate that centrally. So all this means that the relation between things becomes systematic and out of the control of people. This systematicity is an emergent quality that arises from a whole set of individual intentional actions. This is what Marx means when he says that some things happen behind the backs of individuals. This phrase does not point out some ideological defect about not knowing what's really going on in society. It's just another way of saying that there are unintended consequences that are part of a system made up of many perfectly understandable intentional interactions. Many people sneer at the phrase invisible hand. I think a metaphor that Adam Smith only uses once in The Wealth of Nations, but I think this captures something of what Marx meant by use of similar terms. Perhaps if Smith had used it more often and it hadn't been ubiquitously used with his name later, Marx might have even used the borrowed it to get across much the same point, and then we might have had less confusion. Instead, he uses similar phrases all over, phrases such as behind the backs of, by means of invisible strings, and metaphors like laws of nature, to describe pretty much the same thing that Smith was describing. The interdependence of individual actions in a complex system which produces consequences not necessarily intended by those individual actors. Marx's difference with classical political economy does not lie here. It is not a matter of seeing some hidden human power relations where others see none or only invisible ones. He describes something rather similar to Smith's metaphor of a design without a designer. In fact, it was through Darwin that this metaphor of the invisible hand takes on a new meaning as a personification of natural selection. For Smith, the system is guided as if by an invisible hand. This is not to say that Smith believed in some higher intentionality any more than Darwin did in the course of natural evolution. You could call it an as-if intentionality. This is why Marxism and economic conspiracy theories are anathema. Marxism does not posit some actual hidden intentions guiding the system. It's not... It doesn't single out executives, generals, bankers, politicians, capitalists, the trilateral commission that everyone else somehow doesn't see. It's not some hidden hand or hidden fist or visible hand. It's the Jews.
It's always the Jews.
I said it without saying it.
You should really know it.
Yeah. Nor is it the elders of Zion.
That's the truth.
The state is not in control, nor can it be. All it can do is tinker here and there. There is no cabal of sinister people manipulating the system as a whole and all of those caught up in its gears. Marx's critique of political economy also challenges the idea that somehow the system is designed to enrich the capitalist class. rather than their wealth being the byproduct of their role in the accumulation of capital. A better understanding of the commodity fetish will then, I think, yield a much better understanding of capital, the book, as a whole. And indeed, this better understanding of capital has in many ways been stifled by... Oh, can we just start, finish the conclusion?
Yeah.
I didn't see the 1 minute. It's been stifled by a cursory and incorrect reading of the commodity fetishism. And that incorrect reading, I think, loses what is distinctive, whether ultimately right or wrong. I mean, whether Marx is ultimately right or wrong, it loses what's distinctive about Marx's theory of capital. I can only speculate why this reading has persisted and from what kind of attitude to capitalism it arises. But more than a better understanding of capital, the book, or even capital, the process of production and exchange, whether in the past, present, or future, a better understanding of the commodity fetish can also lead to a greater awareness of how another future world is possible, and that, and what would be needed to realize it. If radical critique means getting to the root, then surely we need to better understanding of the root of the capitalist economy, the commodity. Commodity fetishism in all its peculiarities leads back not to consciousness in any way, but back to a system of labor. The fantastically strange results of this total social production process have an earthly origin, but is not an ideological inversion that prevents us from seeing what it really is. It is an inversion in reality that we see for what it really is, even if it takes the theoretical labor of someone like Marx to reveal not what really is behind some illusion, but how the strange phenomena results from everyday productive activity. Marx's difference with classical political economists lies in being the first to question why it is that labor even expresses itself as value in the first place. That's the real radical question. And this is the keystone that's holding up the whole capitalist system. So unlike an illusion, it is not something that can simply be unmasked by raising consciousness. The fetish character of commodities points to a specific mode of production, and if it perhaps doesn't reveal how to change it or what can replace the capitalist mode of production, it does better reveal what it is about the capitalist mode of production that needs changing. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, we'll now have some comments by our discussant in the corner.
I'll try to be brief, and you know, if there's other people who want to say stuff. But I think what we're trying to do, not just here, is have a discussion. A number of us have been talking about these issues for years now, and we're trying to move forward. And I think there were a few points for moving forward here. I think the key thing for people who are new to this is that I think Josh put his finger on like the one concept that you can grasp immediately to understand why there is a problem here. There's all kinds of, you know, socialists and anarchists and people say, well, we'll take over, you know, and then you come up with what you want to do. Well, that's what you want to do. You know, well, the capitalists want high profits, right? But they're in a crisis right now. You know, they didn't want this crisis, okay? So you have unintended consequences. And how do you know you're not going to have unintended consequences, you know, under a new regime where, you know, you got, you know, the people in control? Well, you know, George Orwell talks about, like, where the animals are in control. Well, then it's just, you know, some of the animals are in control, and then they begin to stand up on two legs. You know, that's not what they started with. That's not what they wanted. So this is, I think, a real problem, and this is why I think a real theorization of an alternative to capitalism is extremely necessary, because it's not just a problematic translation of your wants and desires into reality. I think Josh is quite right that this is what Marx got from the classical political economists is this idea of unintended consequences, and you know, in their thinking, it's an invisible hand. Marx transforms it into like an invisible foot, you know. But the point is, it's not intentional. And I think it's kind of like really probably strange for people to encounter humanists. And they don't talk about people, and they're talking about systems and laws and all of that stuff, and it seems like so inhuman. But I think that's the point. To be concrete, if we want a human society, we have to understand this society, its laws, you know, so we can overcome these laws. We have to, you know, overcome the systematic nature The non-human character has to be understood so we'll know what we can do to transform it. So a lot of the times it doesn't seem like there are people in the discussion here, but I think that's very fitting to the nature of the society that we're trying to tear down and create a new one. I think it's also very important, this discussion, in terms of changing the view that we have of Marx. There's this myth around, it's very, very common, that Marx, you know, didn't want to say anything about the new society. He was a theorist of capitalism. He was not a theorist of socialism or the new society. Well, what he didn't want to do was to draw blueprints in the manner of a Fourier, you know, and say we're going to live in communities where there's going to be 8 houses by 8 houses, and here's how we're going to run the communal dining halls or whatever. I mean, that's not the kind of cookbook for the future that he was into. But he talked about the nature of capitalism, what makes it different, what would a communist society be, what would be necessary for that. I think that's all very important. Okay, just a few comments on the individual papers. I think that the one kind of misgiving I have with Anne's paper is the treatment of women as a unit. I think that it would be fruitful to understand some of this dual systems theory, the socialist feminism, and these other tendencies that arose at a certain point in time, in terms of the desire for a separate liberation. And Anne does a good job of talking about that desire for a separate liberation, but I think that that was a middle and upper middle class phenomenon. And I think for upper and middle class women, there has been a certain liberation. You know, I think the glass ceiling has been breached to a very large extent. I mean, they were trying to theorize, I think, their own liberation within capitalism. Because for whatever reason, a lot of them had actually given up on, you know, really transforming society as a whole. So let's talk about ourselves here. And there was a good reason to talk about themselves, because the left had oftentimes neglected them. But so what I'm trying to say is there are class divisions in this discussion, and I don't think it should be treated as just pure ideas. Okay. A second point, I think it would be very helpful to explore this notion that patriarchy is a system. You know, there was something called dual system theory that you're talking about. By virtue of what would patriarchy be a system? Why is that being called a system, and is it not just like a metaphor? Oh, we've got a capitalist system. Everybody used to talk about the capitalist system. Oh, well, we've got a patriarchy system. But, I mean, is there a patriarchy system? What do we mean by system? With regard to Seth's paper, I think it's very intriguing that Rick Wolf picked this engineering and software development, because this is pre-capitalist mode of production. I mean, it's within the capitalist society, but these people are not, their work cannot be regulated, you know, in a Tayloristic manner. You know, they're not going to have bosses because they don't really need bosses. You really can't boss that kind of work. It's very interesting in terms of, oh yeah, we can just do that. Yeah, they can run themselves without bosses, and you know, they've got these skills, and they're very, very different from most workers and peasants and so forth. I think something that would be helpful to explore is this question by Wolf that I don't think, as far as I can see, it was not addressed. Wolf sort of says, well, if these guys, you know, were organized in a communal manner, they would want to obey the government regulations instead of evading them? Well, why? I mean, if you have all these communes and they're in a system of competition, you know, well, you compete with one another better by, you know, evading the regulations so you can get one up on the competitors. So the self-management issue is just, it's kind of like dead in the water here, but it just seems very pure, untheorized to me. Now, I have a question. When Wolf and Resnick and stuff say that there's going to be classes under communism, they mean antagonistic classes with different social interests with regard to what they call the surplus? I mean, we're not going to be ever able to get away with the antagonism among classes? That to me is rather peculiar. And I've spoken a good deal about what Josh said already about the unintended consequences. But I want to say that one thing I found extremely helpful, and I just had never understood, was when Josh talks about this idea of Marx talking about things happening behind the backs of the individuals. And he says, this phrase does not point to some ideological defect about not knowing what's really going on. It's just another way of saying there are unintended consequences that are part of a system. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the way people read Marx was right here. But what I had never understood was why people were getting from Marx this notion that what fetishism consists of is a system in which people don't know what's going on. I knew that they said that. I think it comes from Lukács. Lukács says it. It's kind of bizarre. You know, the workers don't know that they're part of a social labor process. Of course they do. But you know, why is this connected to fetishism? You know, where is it in Marx? Well, I think you're right that's how they're interpreting behind the backs of the individuals. No, it's not behind the backs of the individuals. Behind the backs of the individuals means that there are laws that are not under their control. You know, productivity goes up, prices tend to fall. You know, no one intends for that to happen. It just does happen, and so it's behind the backs of the producers, even though it can be understood. So I'll stop there and open it up.
Okay, the floor is open for discussion.
I have some comments on all the reports, if that's all right. I'll start with Anne's. I thought it was a very good presentation, but I think it could have been supplemented a bit. Firstly, the issue of the personal is political, I think that could have been drawn more sharply by explaining that took two different forms historically. That took this anti-political form on the one hand, that there was this turn to personal, psychological, sexual issues and a rejection of political struggle. On the other hand, it also took a form of single-issue politics. These are my demands, and I want them raised, and I don't care how they're raised or who raises them or what political groups or anything else. And that kind of turn, it's related to my second point here, and that is that the turn by feminists against the what Anne called the old left had everything to do with what Russell Jacoby called social amnesia. Because historically, the left, that is the socialist movement, was the biggest supporter of equality of women. And this goes back to the 19th century, and it goes, there was some tremendous steps forward in the Russian Revolution in the early years of Bolshevik rule. Of course, that got completely undone with the rise of the Stalinist bureaucracy. And after several decades of Stalinism, that history was basically obliterated. So you had this reaction with the new social movement in the 60s of the new left. It was automatically a rejection of what was called the old left without distinguishing within what was the old left, without distinguishing the revolutionary tradition in the left and the Stalinism that replaced it. So that's that. I think your paper could be improved if you added some section on the experiment in equality of women in the Russian Revolution, for instance. On Seth's paper, I thought it was quite. He made some excellent points against Resnick and Wolf. I agree with all of them. My one criticism is I didn't hear anything about the role of the capitalist state here, and that's. The capitalist state is a significant player. You can talk about the mode of production all you like, but eventually you have to deal with the capitalist state, without the undoing of the capitalist state, you cannot transform the mode of production. I understand wasn't your intention to say otherwise, but I think it you need to discuss that. Finally, Josh's paper, I don't agree with this throwaway criticism of Lukács.
and this market.
Yes, commodity fetishism is rooted in production. But it doesn't just remain there. Fetishism becomes a much more general issue throughout society. There are ideological and cultural consequences to fetishism, and that's what Lukács was pointing his finger at. And the determination of everything in terms of quantities is one of those consequences. It begins with a mechanistic view of the world that arises in the 17th century, not coincidentally, at the same time as the rise of merchant capitalism. So I don't think you can discount that, and I think maybe that's related to your dismissal of the role of changing consciousness. Now, I certainly agree that, yes, you can't get away from commodity fetishism by understanding something about it. There has to be a move from theory to practice. But if we can't change consciousness, we'll never get to that point. So I think you have to, ultimately, these issues are not fought out simply in the economic realm, but they're fought out in the political realm. And in the political realm, the transformation of consciousness is everything. So that's my two cents. And I am, by the way, behind all the conspiracies.
Mike in the back had his hand up.
I would just a comment about the people getting the behind the backs of whoever wrong. Maybe it's just a bad translation from the German. Maybe that's why it's that kind of came through. And I have a question about Wolf, and I enjoyed the paper, but. And I like his story. I think he's a compelling storyteller. I mean, just the way that he, from the Marxist tradition, not like he's telling the stories, but the way he explains, takes you through the 70s and explains what happened there. But I wonder I'm not an economist, but I'm also not like a guitar player, but I can tell when something is out of tune. And starting from the commodity and value and taking, you know, any course in capital, how did he, you mentioned postmodernism, and I know he's big out this area, but what are your opinions as to why he totally misses that and thinks co-ops or cooperatives are the way to go?
Can I have a second to think?
We can take some
more. Yeah, I have a general statement, and which will become apparent that I'm really very opposed, which I thought I heard a lot of inaccurate, if not false information, and I dug what Andrew said, and there's, you know, comradely criticisms of others. And then I have a couple of presenters. You know, obviously the title of this workshop makes it apparent, you know, uses the word concretizing Marx's alternative to capitalism, which to me means revising Marxism. And as a Marxist humanist perspective, which I think is, you know, kind of a lie, many activists were pretty cool with the young Marx of the economic manuscripts of 1844 because he talked of alienation, he talked of subjective things, but the mature Marx became very dogmatic, right? Very hard line, and that wasn't okay. That was became known as traditional or orthodox Marxism. You know, the attempts to revise Marx and Marxism goes back about 75 years to the Frankfurt School of Sociology, where they tried to meld Marx and Freud. That was one thing. Then, that's 75 years ago. And since the 30s, there have been many groups in the business of revising Marxism, like, for instance, the Italian Phenomenological School, the Praxis Group in Yugoslavia, the Marxist Humanists in Poland, and more recently, the Euro-Communist perspective in the 70s, which literally, in my view, paved the way to perestroika and what I call the counter-revolution in the Soviet Union. And with tragic worldwide effects on parties, on organizations, on liberation movements. The Polish Marxist Adam Schaff cogently observed in his Marxism and the Individual that all of these attempts to revise Marxism are really rejecting its basic principles. And finally, Marx's genius not only analyzed the bestial system that will kill for profit, but he gave us the essential elements needed for a successful resistance. And a truly liberating perspective that Marxism is by definition humanistic. I'd just like a couple of quick comments on what Anne and Seth said. Anne mentioned, for instance, Margaret Randall and others. She mentioned Schiller with Firestone, but she didn't mention, for instance, Gerda Lerner or Charlene Gautel, who wrote a book called Class or Gender, which is the main contradiction. She came out with class, because she vividly indicated that you can have a revolution without solving completely the gender question, but you can't have it without solving the class question. And also, I really take issue, and I'm part of the end part of the old left. I was section literature director when I thought the Communist Party had something of value in the word communist in 47. Yes, I was in a battle with a bulge, and you're supposed to tell me I don't look that old. Anyway, the point is, you know, I've read Marx, Engels, and yes, even Lenin. And 60 years in the class and anti-imperialist, anti-racist struggles doesn't mean I have all the wisdom. It's just that I've witnessed and practiced some of the results of what I was in. And I presented a paper in 1997 at the Socialist Scholars Conference of anti-communism in a left disguise, using the words pluralism, democratization, right? All the people that rah-rah when they waved the orange flags in the Ukraine against Moscow, they never asked, why does Bush like those orange flags, right? They never asked who benefits, right? What is the question? And, you know, and really, you know, my own son, you know, uses the favorite word, Stalinist, because now there's no Soviet Union. There used to be, you know, first we had, what, the red devil, then the drug devil, and the terrorist devil, but now no more Soviet Union, so therefore we go back to Stalin on the cutting edge. I just want to say also, with what respect that Anne had mentioned, you left out the fact that, yes, the Communist Party was very wanting on the question of gender and sex. I was livid. I mean, I spoke to Gus Hall, not supporting the Equal Rights Amendment, for instance, on some bullshit about protective labor legislation. But they were active on racism and institutionalized racism. So we have to recognize that. And this word that is bandied about by the New Left, by Social Democrats, by neo-Marxists, of state capitalism. Well, what do they have in Cuba? Isn't the defining thing that there's social ownership of the means of production and not private ownership? So you're going to say, oh, well. And by the way, just let me remind those that are hung up on Stalinism and women who that had lofty positions in the Soviet Union all through the decades as professors, as doctors, as everything else. Unheard of achievements in this on the planet, like Cuba, like sending more doctors out than the UN Health Organization, 99% literacy, bicycles not chained to the wall, no homeless, no unemployed. Oh, don't compare it to the standard of living here, because we've raped countries and took out their resources. So that bothers me that, you know, this concept of a state capitalism, you know, that they're really not socialism. Well, what is it? Who owns the means of production? So you ought to go to Havana, that Obama's lifting the, you know. So anyway, so I just want to say...
We can't possibly cover all
yeah,
these
okay.
topics
no, I know. I appreciate
today,
that. And
so
I just, you know, dug what Andrew gave as comradely criticism, right? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, floor is open. Someone who hasn't spoken yet first.
Hey, gotta say something.
I'll respond to some things, and then I'm going to take more questions too. First of all, I don't see how concretizing ever had anything remotely etymologically to do with revising. I agree with you that many people have sought to revise Marx, and I think Stalinists are among the worst. But I also disagree with what you're critiquing. That, you know, people think that the old Marx is not humanist, not, you know, cold and whatever. It's like, this is exactly, I think, what Andrew was saying. Just because he's talking about systematic things doesn't mean he wasn't a humanist and he wasn't into human liberation. And I would even agree, although not for the reasons you do, I would agree with your critique of the Frankfurt School. And I think part of the Frankfurt School legacy is thinking that, you know, there is going to be that the mechanization itself is part of the liberation from capitalism. That's a separate debate. To answer Alex, yeah, you identified exactly the difference. I don't think that Lukács' theory of reification has been consistent with Marx's concept of commodity fetishism. Now, you can say that the fetish has consequences elsewhere, and I think Marx develops this in terms of the money fetish and the capital fetish and such. And you could even say that this is a general issue that, you know, spreads through a bunch of institutions in society. But I think you need a theory of that, and I don't think that Lukács' theory is consistent with Marx. And if you want to call it something else, call it something else. But I don't know that it has anything to do with fetishism. They can make a critique of the mechanistic view of the world and you know, positivist view of society and quantification. But I don't know. Some of it, I think, is actually orthogonal to like Marxist theory. I mean,
you're saying that has nothing to do with commodity fetishism? No. Completely unrelated?
No, I mean, you can make the argument it has something to do with capitalism somehow, but it's not there in Capital, I don't think. I mean, it's there in Lukács, I agree, but I don't agree with Lukács.
I'm sorry that I was very late and I did not hear what you said. I'm sorry I wasn't here. I was very late and I wasn't here to hear what was heard on women's issues. But I did hear the criticism or your critique about the personalist, the political, and that it's, from what he said, that it splintered into two directions. Now, I don't know whether that was coming from what you said originally about women's issues. But as a feminist who was part of the second wave of feminism and who's pretty saddened and disheartened by what is going on now, I was wondering if Arielle Levy, the feminist who has written on, she wrote a wonderful book called The Female Chauvinist Pig, and how sex in the city is a metaphor for the degeneration of the idea of the personal is the political. But I don't believe that that is political. I think that's apolitical.
So. Mm-hmm.
Is that for you,
for you
to answer?
I'd love to hear
your comments
on that.
I mean, Mike sort of asked, you know, why does Richard Wolff go Rick Wolff go in the direction he does? And my first thought was, like Mike said, I mean, it's the Althusserian stuff, it's the Pomo stuff. But then you sort of think about it, and there's so many other people who've gone in the same direction that the Wolf has gone in, namely sort of advocating some kind of like worker self-management or workers' control of production. And people like Naomi Klein come to mind, or Michael Leibowitz. And I think the answer is kind of simple. Maybe I'm missing something, but I think it's just that they never really understood Marx. I think that's it.
The questioner asked the question about what happened to the personal. You're addressing a totally different.
I'll address her question.
Sorry.
So that's my. I mean, perhaps Mike has a bit better. That's all. That's what comes to my mind. I would like to respond quickly to Alice's point about the state. I think like we're in a period where we're sort of presented with a kind of false dichotomy between, like, on the one hand, either we're told we have to seize state power, or on the other hand, we're told we have to somehow find a way to circumvent state power. Like, you know, we'll build stuff in the interstices because, you know, seizing state power, you know, it's not gonna work. But I think that Marx, you know, particularly in his writings in the Paris Commune, suggests a different kind of direction, right? I mean, he says in the Paris Commune that the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. And in fact, in a letter to Dr. Kugelman, he actually said that we need to smash the state.
And seize power. And seize power.
Not state power.
I mean, Marx describes the Paris Commune as the political form at last discovered under which to work out the economical emancipation of labor. And Marx says, except on this last condition, the economic emancipation of labor, the communal constitution would have been an impossibility and a delusion. His point being that the political rule of the producer can't coexist with the perpetuation of social slavery. So I mean, I think that like the state is a crucial question, but again, like the political rule of the producer can't coexist with the perpetuation of social slavery. I mean, you have to you need a new mode of production, right? I mean, I think that's the thing.
Check out page 18 of the Communist Manifesto.
Okay. Did you want to answer the question?
so much to talk about. I was not attempting to give a history of the women's movement for all times or places. I was attempting to address what I think is an impediment to feminists today from looking at Marx. So I was when I was younger, but not now, trying to prove that Marx was a good guy, that he said nice things about women, that the Russian Revolution at first was tremendous on women, although they were, when they had the early Women's Commission, was busy remaking everything, communal kitchens and great stuff. I don't feel like those historic examples mean a lot to young people a century later. I'm really trying to appeal to people's intellect to consider what a mess we're in, and how women's rights are going backwards at an enormous pace everywhere in the world, including this country, and just because Obama's in, we can't relax. They're still trying to take away all our rights in this country. And certainly, you know, every time you open the newspaper, there's another woman stoned to death somewhere, and it's horrible. I agree with, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, Elizabeth, that there's been a horrible depoliticalization of what feminism means. And but there's been a depoliticalization of what everything means, I think. In other words, certain gains were made in the movements of the 60s and 70s, and they've all been seriously injured by the Reagan-Bush counter-revolution. And we need to try to find people who are interested in a sense, starting over. So
quickly say what that impediment is that you were mentioning, that Freud...
Oh, I was discussing the personal as political, having been raised, I mean, I remember too, I go back then, it was raised to be more inclusive, not to define politics just as the government or the economic conditions, but politics is everything. That's the way I understood it at the time, and I mentioned the philosopher Raya Dunayevskaya, who actually wrote about the phrase, but it was taken by some people to mean we're not interested in politics, we're only interested in personal, psychological, family relations or whatever. So, you know, it could go several ways.
Okay.
That's all I was saying.
By Ariel Levy in her book, The Female
Chauvinist. Yeah, it sounds like it. I haven't read it, but I've heard about it. Yeah.
Elizabeth, when you said second wave, did you mean the 60s?
70s. Okay. Anyone else who hasn't spoken first? Okay.
Well, thanks for giving me a second round. Just a couple of points. I think it would be important to get into some of this historical material because there's a real burning necessity to connect the younger generation with the history of these movements. Stalinism did enormous damage, as did the New Left. And the New Left sort of reacted understandably to the crimes of Stalinism, but by exercising this history, they were basically rudderless. So I think it would be important to bring that out for the new generation. And another point I wanted to make, I forgot to mention this in reply to Josh. He said at the very end, he made some remark against central planning. Now, yeah, I agree. Central planning, the kind of old-style central planning where the five people in the Politburo make all the decisions, that's not going to work in the kind of globalized world economy we have today. But then we have to theorize what is the alternative to the invisible hand. Well, clearly the alternative is planning of some sort. I think with the means we have available today, that you can have a kind of a combination of central planning and decentralized planning. I think that's very possible, and I think that makes that can make issues of local autonomy viable as well as address the needs of a global economy. But how that's to be done, that has to obviously be theorized, and I think it's not at all premature for us to try to theorize these things, despite all sorts of injunctions against creating blueprints. I think that it would be a very good project for budding young economists, sociologists, ecologists, to try to address these kind of issues. What could be the alternative mode of production on a world basis, provided we're on the other side of a social revolution? And one final thing, this is to the questioner before. I respect anyone who's been actively involved as long as you have, but I really think you gotta ask yourself something about Stalinism. It's not just an issue of yesterday. Stalinism did achieve a certain equality of women in the sense that all the women that were in the gulag were equal to the men.
All starved to death again.
This personal.
I just want to say one little thing. I haven't heard one very important concept here which has to fit in somewhere, and that's democracy. And I think we have to have democracy if we're going to solve problems. And we have to have people at the bottom, working people, to come up with the answers of how to transform the economy, how to achieve a just society, and all the oppression, terrible things. If we come from the bottom, not from the top, you can be the nicest, best, smartest people. But if you sit in a room and you try to figure it out and you give orders out, it'll go wrong. It went wrong in Russia. They only had a heritage of feudalism and czars. And in China, too, with the feudal lords. They didn't understand democracy. They didn't, the socialists and the communists didn't use it. And I feel that is the solution to finding a path towards creating socialism, which would be through mobilizing people themselves, figuring out what they have to do and how to solve the problem.
May I just respond? I agree with your principle, but I wouldn't call it democracy, because democracy sort of doesn't mean anything unless you talk about the content of it. You know, are the people contributing ideas for a new society or for something unimportant? What I would call it is developing a new relationship between theory and practice. between working people and our kind of professional revolutionaries that think about this stuff all the time. Having a dialogue that's continuous and engaging in this project together. When we say we're challenging everyone to work on theorizing alternatives to capitalism, we mean everyone, not just the left, which is, you know, so inconsequential today, or the intellectuals, but workers too. And I think it become very real question to workers if in this economic crisis or after it, there are movements to actually change and get rid of capitalism. People are going to want to know, can we replace capitalism with something? Before I knock myself out, you know, risking my job striking or risking my life, rebelling in the streets, you know, is it possible to make something really different? And I think that we have to be ready to discuss that now and later and all the time with people, not to make it an issue for intellectuals, but to make it an issue for everyone. And that's something that my group, the Marxist Humanist Initiative, considers a priority. Not for us to do alone, we're a little bitty group, but for everyone to talk about and start working on. And women, particularly, there are plenty of women on the bottom who still, you know, I think, want to change the world. So
Can I just ask a question?
I'm sorry, we
got to
go.
I'm going to talk to Alex. Again, you like, your comments are insightful.
He's after you.
No, it's very helpful. This is what Marxism is about. It's
sharp comradely criticism.
But, I mean, it helps you sharpen your ideas. It depends on what you call planning, but I think there is a role for voluntaristic, like, you know, distribution of things in a socialist society. After all, there's all sorts of redistribution in this society. I mean, people aren't just paid their wages. There's all sorts of, you know, the negative taxes. There's like all sorts of things that capitalism does besides the wage relation to redistribute. So that's not out of the question. But fundamentally, it is a system in which there is a labor market, and that's how you're remunerated. So just fundamentally, we need a new way of allocating resources and remuneration that isn't fundamentally centrally planned, or even locally centrally planned. Like, and this is something I was going to say in response to Andrew when he says, like, you know, humanists talking about systems and laws. I'm not necessarily sure that systems are all bad. I mean, we're talking about a capitalist system in which there is a relation of commodity production, but there could be another system, a spontaneous order arising out of people's, you know,
and what
creativity.
Do you call that other system?
Socialism.
Okay,
that's not the issue. The issue is the spontaneity of it. And I'm not saying, you know, against organization. I'm saying, like, for a viable society, for a viable economy to persist, I think there has to be an element of that unplannedness. Because I don't think there is a political answer. I think, you know, if you like leave it up to, you know, planners, you're going to have corruption and other things. There needs to, that's saying there's not a role for that. So the alternative to the invisible hand isn't necessarily planning. Could be a different
question.
We don't have time. I'm sorry.
Okay, we're supposed to end at 5.
We have 3 minutes.
Well, can I just make an announcement about our literature table? Or did I already? We have a table. If you go down the west elevators to the basement and go in the book rooms, we're the first table on the...
In the west building?
In the west, yeah, okay. Side. But we're not there now. We're all here. So, but they're going to make us close down by 5:30. Come down and take a look at our literature and talk to us there if you would, so that you know, we have time before we have to close it down.
Ask something. Well, she mentioned democracy in a general way.
I'm sorry.
We have bourgeois democracy. Does that mean Cuba is a dictatorship? Because, yes. You know, they have a democracy. No, that's wrong. They have more democracy than we have.
Long time. People would like to sign our mailing list.
I would have been to this panel first. instead of the other things I was talking about.
If anyone would like to sign our mailing list to have more discussion.
I don't know.
I saw them on Friday night, and it's like, I don't hear from anybody.